Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Manufacturing Talk Radio, the only show that takes a look at the obstacles and opportunities open to small to mid-sized enterprises that manufacture here in America. Brought to you by All Metals and Forge Group, with your hosts, Tim Grady and Lou Wise.
Welcome, everyone, to Manufacturing Talk Radio. My name is Tim Grady. I'm here with my co-host, Lou Wise. Lou is the president of All Metals and Forge Group and the sponsor of Manufacturing Talk Radio. Lou, how are you today?
Doing great as usual. We have wonderful weather up here in New Jersey. It's about 45, 50 degrees outside. You ought to come up here from Atlanta where it's nice and warm.
Yeah, we had a freeze warning here in Atlanta last night. So.
Yeah, that'll teach you move to Atlanta.
That's right. Well, if you would be kind enough to give our listeners a snapshot of last week's show, and then we're anxious to hear Lou's news.
Love to do it. Last week, we had an economic forecast by MAPI, which is the Manufacturers Alliance for Productivity and Innovation. We had Cliff Wallman, who's the Director of Economic Studies at the MAPI, and had given us quite in-depth economic forecast globally, in addition to the report they came out with, an important research report on productivity and manufacturing. It may seem dry, but, you know, for our listeners who are business-related, manufacturing-related, I think it's really important that you understand the numbers. And we do have a considerable number of economists that are on our show who give us the numbers, and they go into quite the depth. And I think it's important in you looking at your manufacturing, your sales, your production, your employees, and so on. So Cliff Wallman is a great listen, and I recommend that you go to mfgtalkradio.com, and it was last week's show. It's right on our homepage. Regarding some Lou's news, a couple of interesting things. We're not going to talk politics because that's really getting old and fuzzy, hairy. So we're going to talk about some new technologies that's hitting the news stands. Goodyear Tire has come up with a new concept. It's not in production yet. They're still working on the idea. And the idea, which is absolutely brilliant, is about generating electricity from your tire, where as the tire rotates, it becomes hot, it generates heat, the heat generates electricity. And his primary thought was that they would use this on hybrid or electric cars to expand the range that a car can go. But they're also talking about it for regular cars. And, you know, they'll come up with the technology and then they'll figure out what it is they're going to use it for. But it's a great idea. And it's going to actually wind up saving you a lot of money on gas. Of course, the tire prices are probably going to be $1,000 a tire. But we'll see how that works out. Along with that, U.S. Navy, this is incredible. We've been talking about 3D printing for the last 2 years, and the industry in itself has grown by billions just since Tim and I have been talking about it. Well, here it is. The U.S. Navy is putting 3D printing machines on every ship in the Navy as it progresses. Right now it's on the aircraft carrier U.S. Harry Truman, as it should be. He was a great president. And it's on an assault ship. They're testing it. And what they're testing it is that, you know, during the course of missions or just cruising around, there are parts that do break and they're stuck. They need to get parts from home base. Well, here they're now going to be able to print it right on the ship. Great savings. And the parts, generally speaking, are going to be a lot less expensive than having to send an airplane back to home base to pick up a 2-inch screw. So that's a pretty neat story. news on oil. Wow, we're getting all excited about this because we in the manufacturing world, we need expensive oil. And at least in the $40, $50 range. Well, it hit $41 yesterday. Problem, though, the Interior Department stated that drilling off of the coast of Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida will not be auctioned off anymore. So thank you, Uncle Sam. And our last is Lockheed Martin. They are now getting into the commercial market, and the famous Skunk Works, has designed a freight transportation system of a hybrid airship. It's really a goofy-looking thing. It looks like a huge porpoise, and they're working on that now. It's 280 feet long, and it will be able to carry 50,000 pounds of materials, and they expect it to be in service by 2018. That's amazing, and it may be a great aid in regards to the trucks that are on the road, that perhaps we'll have less trucks on the road and have more of these in the air, but it's quite a sight. Tim, I think that's it for my news. I'm going to turn the show back to you, and let's get it on the road.
Well, let's talk about reshoring and getting those companies to bring their employees and their jobs and their technology back home. We have Rosemary Coates with us. She's executive director of the Reshoring Institute. The Reshoring Institute is organized under the University of San Diego, great school. Rosemary, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. And I would like to add that I'm in Silicon Valley and the weather here is spectacular.
That's not even fair. We won't talk to you about the weather.
Did the Department of Commerce out there pay you to make that statement?
Yeah, we don't need a Department of Commerce. It's California, you know?
Yeah, that's right. It's always beautiful in California, particularly where you are. Rosemary, would you give our listeners a feel for what the Reshoring Institute is and does, please?
Sure. So a little bit of background. I have my own consulting firm. I've been doing global manufacturing strategy and execution for the last 25 years or so. And a couple years ago, well, I had been helping lots of companies expand their operations in China and sourcing in China. I've been doing that for about 15 years. And a couple years ago, we started the Reshoring Institute as we were talking to executives who were interested in, you know, taking a more strategic view and determining if, in fact, they could bring manufacturing back to the U.S. So the Institute is established under the University of San Diego, as you mentioned before, and that's for a couple of very good reasons. First of all, because I'm an alumni, that's where I went to graduate school, and I'm on the board at USD, so I went to them and asked them if they would host us there. And then also because they have a very extensive graduate program in supply chain management and a couple of international programs as well. So it seemed like a perfect fit where we could get tucked under the university and use their facilities as well as their professors and also have access to graduate student interns. So it made for a very nice combination. Now, the Reshoring Institute is an independent body. We don't get funding from the university, but we do get contributions in kind, like they help us with meeting space and they give us admin support, and we have one of the people from the Supply Chain Management Institute is on our board, and you know, we get 3 student interns every semester and so forth. So it's a mutually beneficial relationship and one that we think works quite well, and you know, it's just going gangbusters.
What's the name of your consultancy and what the URL is?
My consulting firm is Blue Silk Consulting. and it's www.bluesilkconsulting.com. And that I've been in the big consulting world for going on 30 years now. I worked for KPMG, Pete Marwick, and was a partner at AnswerThink Consulting, and I also ran business consulting for SAP, a big software firm. But in 2007, I decided I really wanted to focus on China. And the reason why is because so much manufacturing was going there. And since that was my field, I was very interested in China and decided to start the firm to really focus on that. And I did, and then I wrote a book about China, which has been a bestseller on Amazon for 5 or 6 years. I don't know who's buying it now, but I did that. And I also do expert witness work for companies that are involved in supply chain disputes. So that's what the consulting firm does, and we work on, you know, bigger strategy projects and so forth. The Reshoring Institute is much more focused on smaller projects and research.
Well, I'm glad, Rosemary, that you're using student interns on some of these projects. I've always felt that business was kind of missing an opportunity by not partnering with universities when they've got so many bright people coming through the university, particularly at the graduate level, to get these folks involved in research and development initiatives for the business. And more universities are doing that, but probably not near enough. So kudos to you and the University of San Diego for getting students involved in the very early stages of this.
Yeah, thank you. They're pretty spectacular, too, I have to say. They're, you know, fresh-faced young people who don't have any experience, but they're so willing to learn and really bright. So they help us with the deep dive research that we're doing all the time. And, you know, they're going to be the executives of the future. So we want to make sure that we are shaping what they think about manufacturing and make sure that they know it's important to reestablish manufacturing in America.
So let's talk a little bit about where reshoring is. You know, offshoring, I guess, began to occur in Ernst in the 90s. And I don't know how many companies or jobs went offshore. What's happening in terms of reshoring and businesses coming back?
I would say pretty much now the job losses are balanced with the job creation in the U.S., which includes brand new establishment of manufacturing as well as a foreign direct investment and also actually bringing manufacturing back here. So the combination of the three roughly balances what's going out. You know, we think we're excited, obviously, and this is a passion for us. So, you know, we're very positive, but there are certainly a lot of naysayers. And when I hear people saying, "Oh, it's not happening," or you know, it's not a building trend or whatever, I always tell them you got to think of the words of that great philosopher Taylor Swift. Haters gonna hate, you know.
That's a great line.
Yeah. So you know, we never thought that it was going to be a huge fad and that, you know, a huge enormous wave of reshoring would come back. I mean, I don't think any of us in the industry or working on reshoring thought that would happen. I mean, this is hard work. There's no question about it. We need to educate manufacturers about the benefits of manufacturing in the U.S. We have to work with economic development people to offer incentives. We have to support politicians who are not giving tax breaks for offshoring. You know, that's really important. I mean, this is really a three-legged stool. We have to have industry on one leg. We have to have the communities on the second leg, and we need to have government. We have to have government on the third leg. So the government has to create an environment where it's beneficial. We have to have consumers and communities who are asking for American-made goods, and we have to have businesses that are willing to do it. So, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. Doesn't happen with the click of a finger. You've got to, with the snap of your fingers, you have to really work hard at this and keep pushing the momentum. And we think we're making pretty good progress in that regard.
Rosemary, the I think the government has a large role to play in this, as you mentioned, and certainly corporate tax reform would certainly help. That would give the incentives to not blow offshore and take a 20-30% improvement in profitability by not paying their taxes. But then you have other situations, and I've heard recently, and I don't know how accurate this number is, perhaps you could even support it or negate it, that there's only really been about 65 companies that have come back to the U.S. over the last year. Again, I don't know if that's a real number or a naysayer number, but it doesn't sound like a lot. And then you still have those who are leaving in droves. General Electric has moved two plants, one to England and one to Canada. You have Caterpillar, who has left. You have Carrier Air Conditioner, who's left. Nabisco has left. It seems as though that the big names are still planning to move out.
Well, I think there's I would look at this differently. I think there's a different point of view. So a couple of things. First of all, I've been in this industry for a very long time, and it used to be executives were chasing the next lowest cost place. Where could they go, and how could they expand globally to take advantage of low-cost markets and so forth? I really see the attitude changing, though. Today's executives and supply chain, and in supply chain I would include operations, so in supply chain as well as the CEO, are thinking much, much more strategically and looking at the world, taking a step back, looking at the world and saying, where in the world should we manufacture? Not should we move to Canada or should we move to Mexico or should we offshore to China? That's not the conversation anymore. It's much more about what should the global landscape look like. So by that I mean, executives, and we would coach them to do this, saying, what should we actually manufacture in China to address the Chinese market or to address the low end of our products? And what should we manufacture in the U.S. to address the U.S. market? And that, in fact, GE is a very good example of that. As you probably know, they reopened Appliance Park in Louisville. And Appliance Park had been shuttered completely, and everything was moved overseas under Jack Welch's reign. But when Jeff Immelt came back, and more recently, they've been looking at what products are selling in the U.S. that they could manufacture here. And so the results were an innovative product called a GeoSpring water heater, which heats on demand. And they started with that and reopened some sections of Appliance Park in Louisville, which had been completely closed down. And because they innovated that product, so here's the economics of it. Most of us have those big white water heaters in the garage or the basement that's heating water all day long. So for me, I'm off traveling the world. I'm in China, and by God, my water heater in Silicon Valley is heating water just in case somebody needs hot water while I'm away. It was a really silly idea, right? So GE innovated a water heater that is heat on demand, the GeoSpring. And so when you turn the tap on, you get instant hot water. Makes perfect sense. However, it's much more expensive. So it's about $3,500 for that particular product. The big white water heaters are only $1,000. So there's, an economic choice. And GE knows through their surveys that in the Western world, sometimes high-end water heaters are sold here or they're sold in Western Europe. So why produce those things in China? Because they're going to be shipped here. So they innovated a product. They identified the Western market, which is where they're going to sell, and they started producing here for the local market. So this is the kind of decision that, I'm talking about where I say executives are taking a more strategic view. They're trying to determine where are their markets and what products could be sold in those markets and how could we manufacture them locally in each of those markets. So the big white water heaters have stayed in China, by the way, and they're still being produced there.
Meanwhile, to replace a white big hot water heater in Bergen County, unless you don't know Bergen County, it's not $1,000 event.
Okay.
That's the labor they add on.
Yeah. Well, so anyway, I think there's a pretty big evolution going on, which is it's different from just saying we used to do this, now we're doing that. I mean, this is really an evolutionary process where executives are rethinking what's going on. You know, you had mentioned one other thing too about government support. Unbeknownst to most of us, in 2014, the Congress passed a bipartisan, which, sort of a miracle, I guess, bipartisan bill to support the U.S. Manufacturing Revitalization Act. That was in 2014. And that is funding innovation centers across America, particularly in the Rust Belt, to study and to support advanced manufacturing. So this is a really important component of reshoring. We need to have automation inserted into the equation, and that's because we need to extract labor out of manufacturing costs. So advanced manufacturing and actually the funding and the support for advanced manufacturing is a very important aspect of reshoring as well.
Rosemary, do you have any feel for what kind of count in terms of companies or jobs or some statistics that indicate to our listeners what kind of reshoring is taking place?
Yeah, I heard you say 65 before, and actually that's the first time I've heard that number. I would say that's way low. We're talking to companies every day. I think it's hard to put a number on it because, the reason why it's hard is it's not just about the number of companies that left and the number of companies that came back. That's the easy part to count. What's harder is a lot of the companies that we're talking to are saying, we need to build a new manufacturing plant. Do we do that in Pudong, China, or Shenzhen? Or do we talk to the local people in Medford, Oregon, and, think about manufacturing there? So it's not a... Sometimes it's not a decision to bring something back. It's really a decision to establish manufacturing in a brand new location. So it's hard to characterize those numbers. And I also think statistics are not the best way to tell the story either. The better way to tell the story is to think about why and how and what's the approach and what are they thinking about in terms of establishing here.
Now, how do the students get involved in this at the University of San Diego?
Well, we take 3 paid student interns, so we pay them $1,750 a semester each, and that hopefully goes for their tuition, not beer.
Oh, you're no fun.
I hope. Yeah, I hope. It is college. That's right. I have a director of research who manages the interns for me. And so at the beginning of the semester, we decide on what they're going to focus on. So, for example, right now I've got one intern who's writing a case study on a racing bicycle manufacturer in the L.A. area that is using 3D printing, had brought back manufacturing from Taiwan and is focusing on 3D printing. I have another intern who is doing research on automation, the 3 key technologies, which we say are robotics and 3D printing and 5-axis milling. So he's writing a white paper on that. I have another intern that's focused on the political environment and what are the platforms of the candidates and how are they talking about those. So we give them research projects, and then they go off and do the research and then write about it. And all of that is published on our website, thereshoringinstitute.org. All of that's free. Anybody can go there and download all that stuff and see the good research that we're doing. So, you know, that's the kind of way that we approach it.
Well, I think that one of the things that is driving this, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the supply chain itself. I know that back in November of 2014 through about April or May of 2015, we went through the West Coast port slowdown. And I think that may have been the final wake-up call to everybody saying, you know, your supply chain is too long, it's too complex. For those things that are better made in America, we need to shorten that supply chain. Is that what the Supply Chain Institute at the University of San Diego is discovering as it looks at this as well?
Yeah, you know, we use the port slowdown as a great example of risk in the supply chain and what happens when you have extended lengthy supply chains around the world. You know, it's funny that you bring that up. It's about a year ago I spoke at the National Industrial Bag Manufacturers Conference, which doesn't sound like it would be that exciting, right? That's what I thought, too. But, man, were those guys interesting, I have to say. I mean, they make industrial bags for all kinds of applications, for, you know, these huge bags for food applications or, you know, different shipping applications and all kinds of stuff. And so they're industrial bags. They're not paper bags like you get at the grocery store, but industrial bags. And they are pretty much manufacturing all over the world as well. And when the West Coast port strike happened, it pretty much choked these companies. I mean, they had incoming bags, which were to be just-in-time delivered to manufacturing sites, and they couldn't get them through the port. And so on the other side, in the their customers all across America were waiting on bags, and, of course, they had to stop production because if they produce something and there's no bag to put it in, what do you do with it? And so, you know, that was a real eye-opening situation for them, and they were very focused on seeing if they could manufacture within the U.S. because of that. So, you know, there are you know, good examples like that where companies now have a wake-up call with respect to their global supply chain, saying, "Holy cow! You know, this puts our business at risk if we continue these long supply chains and have no alternatives when things like the port strike happened."
Tim and I were working on that project, and I think we had four or five shows about it, and we learned really a lot about what was going on. And, you know, when we finally heard the number that was costing our country, which was $1 billion a day, it really riled us up. We contacted the White House, and we got a comment back that they're doing the right job. Meanwhile, it was a week or two later where the Secretary of Labor, Secretary of Commerce, went to California, and they effectively put an end to it. But you're right. I mean, it went on for 7-8 months. The country lost a lot of money. Manufacturers lost a lot of money. People who were exporting perishables, fruits, vegetables, livestock. It was a terrible event.
Yeah, and of course, I live in the Bay Area, so, you know, it was big news here every day, and we were watching it, but, you know, I didn't really feel the personal loss until I was talking to the bag manufacturers, and then it was awful. It was really awful.
Well, you know, we're always talking about the big guys, the GEs, the Walmarts, the major corporations in America that are involved in reshoring. Rosemary, are there any smaller mid-sized enterprises involved in reshoring?
Yeah, a lot. And, in fact, I think that's where most of it is coming from. And especially because the smaller manufacturers are way more vulnerable. That is, you know, if they have an interruption in their business, it could bankrupt them. So they don't, you know, have a lot of money to rely back on or working capital that they can tap into. So, you know, we are seeing that vulnerability in their supply chain, and as a result, thinking about reshoring. So I'll give you a couple of examples. We worked with a lighting company here in the Bay Area. They make industrial lighting for retailers, so the lights that go under the shelves and display cases and that sort of thing. They manufacture this as a specialty item, partly assembling in the U.S. and getting their components from China. And so they were interested in labeling their product made in the USA. And as you probably know, that is a legal requirement. And there are state laws as well as there's the FTC governing law that says all or nearly all, that's the actual language from the law, all or nearly all, yeah, of course you can't define that, right, of the components, raw materials, and final finished product must be made or products of the United States. So this lighting company came to us and said, what do we do with that? You know, how do we know what's nearly all? So we did a small consulting project for them and gave them recommendations on how to label their product. And the intent, of course, of the Federal Trade Commission is truth in advertising. So they want Americans to know, where are your products coming from? And so we recommended to this company that they label their product assembled in the USA of 85% American-made parts, because that gives the end consumer really good information, right? So that tells the end consumer, wow, these guys have a handle on it. They know what they're doing. And obviously, you know, anybody in the electronics industry would know that you couldn't possibly get all the components in the U.S. I mean, electronics are, the preponderance of global electronics are in China. So that gives, you know, with that kind of label, that tells the American consumer, this is on the up and up, we're telling the truth. And so, you know, that's typical. Yeah, that's typical of a kind of project that we would do. Another one of our projects, I think I had mentioned before, one of my interns is writing a case study right now. It's a racing bicycles, and it's called IRT Racing. And they make a hub for a wheel that is very, very popular among racing cyclists. And that hub was, they had paid for a mold in China. Or in Taiwan, I'm sorry, in Taiwan, that was very expensive. I think it was about $25,000 or $30,000 to do the mold. And then they were producing product in China, in Taiwan and China. They had a long, long supply chain. They had all kinds of issues with quality and so forth. So the president of the company got really frustrated, and he bought a 3D printer. And so he figured out how to operate it, and they started printing the hubs, which right now are much higher quality. They're print on demand, so if a cyclist, a competitor, needs a new hub for his wheel, he can get it in pretty much 24 hours. You know, so it's just an amazing, amazing story. And, you know, they're more expensive, of course. They're very expensive. But these are racing cyclists who, you know, are racing on $50,000, $60,000 bicycles. So, it makes sense. And he's been wildly successful. So that's another good example, you know, of a small business that's actually reshoring.
Those are great stories. And we appreciate them, Rosemary. We're going to be right back after a few commercial breaks from our advertisers and the sponsor of the show, All Metals and Forge Group. So Manufacturing Talk Radio, stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Manufacturing Talk Radio will be right back.
American Crane and Equipment Corporation in Douglasville, Pennsylvania, is a leader in specialized cranes, hoists, and material handling equipment for industries including aerospace, nuclear, oil and gas, transit, construction, and waste handling. Call 877-877-6778 or visit AmericanCrane.com. That's AmericanCrane.com or 877-877-6778.
All Metals and Forge Group is an ISO 9001 AS and EN 9100 manufacturer of open die forgings and seamless rolled rings in alloy, carbon, stainless and tool steels, aluminum, copper, titanium, and nickel alloys. Visit us at steelforge.com or call 800-600-9290.
How do you keep your business humming? Where do you go when you're looking for quality suppliers of new equipment? Components, MRO supplies, repair services, or even raw materials. 30 years ago, you would have turned to the Thomas Register. Today, those big green books are better than ever at thomasnet.com, industry's leading platform for product sourcing and supplier discovery. You can easily find that local machine shop, national distributor, OEM, or any supplier having the right quality certification. Fast and free. You can even get to specific products, components, or downloadable 3D CAD drawings simply by entering specifications or part numbers. There's a reason ThomasNet.com has become the go-to supplier discovery tool for procurement professionals and engineers. There's simply no other resource like it, and it's all free. Go to ThomasNet.com today and see how top-notch supplier discovery doesn't have to put a dent into your bottom line.
Welcome back to Manufacturing Talk Radio.
You're listening to Manufacturing Talk Radio with Tim Grady and Lou Weiss. We're the leading source for information for the manufacturing industry. And we're speaking with Rosemary Coates, Executive Director of the Reshoring Institute, about companies bringing jobs and back to America and manufacturing back in America. We've talked to her about some of the large OEMs that have done it and also some of the small and mid-sized enterprises that are doing it as well. Rosemary, I know that Lou's got a question up his sleeve. I'm going to flip it over to Lou and let him fire away here.
Yes. The first part of the show, we talked about the services and what you do. What I'd like to know is, let's make a hypothetical case that I'm an American manufacturer and I have a facility in Shanghai. And, you know, we've had all the issues and quality issues and language issues and long supply chain and so on. And we're deciding to come back. How do we do that? Who do we have to talk to?
That is a great question. That's a great question. Yeah, because I spent so much time dealing with offshoring to China, and I spent, made many trips and spent lots of weeks in China helping companies establish manufacturing there or expand their facilities. That's a unique service offering that we have that I don't think anyone else that's working in this space really has to offer. And there's several of us on my team who have feet on the street in China, and we have, walked lots of manufacturing sites and know how business is conducted there. And so to extract yourself from China is not easy. I tell you, it's not like, turning off the lights and shutting the door and walking away. There is a whole process, and you need to be extremely, extremely cautious and careful about how you're executing. So the first thing is you typically have to apply for a permit to leave. So the government grants you a business license, but then they also need to grant you a license to shut down or to leave. And the reason why that's important, sure, you could pick up and get on an airplane and go away. But if you do that, your name will be on a list somewhere, and you may never be able to reestablish relationships in China or manufacturing China. Or in some cases, you may not even be able to get a visa to come back. So I always caution my clients, don't do that. Go through proper channels, take the time, and make sure that you're exiting appropriately. The second thing to watch for is employment contracts. So in China, most employees are on a contract, so they have a 1-year or 2-year contract with you. And if you shut down operations, you have to pay out that contract. And so a lot of people don't know about that, or they forget about it and think that they're just going to tell people, oh, you're laid off now, bye-bye, right, like we would in the U.S., but that's not the case in China. You have to buy out those contracts. About a year ago or so, there was this guy named Chip Starnes. I don't know if you saw him in the news. He was a medical device manufacturer in China, and he was chasing the low-cost labor markets and decided to move to India where he could manufacture even cheaper. And so he was shutting down operations and just going to move, didn't tell anybody. And his employees got wind of what was happening, and they captured him and put him in his office, and they kept him there for 2 weeks. And they stood outside because they wanted to get their employment contracts paid out. So the poor guy, I mean, they didn't hurt him, and they gave him food and everything, so he was fine. But he had to live in his office for 2 weeks until he agreed to pay the employment contract out. So, you know, that can certainly happen. So employees' contracts is something you need to be very fully aware of. And then, you know, another issue is the tools and molds and dyes that you may have sent to China, which in the customs world we call assists, where you are sending some kind of equipment that helps manufacture a part. And a lot of times, you know, executives will say, yeah, we're going to shut down and we're going to bring back our equipment, which makes me laugh because once you send something to China, they look at it as becoming part of the plant infrastructure. And unless you have really tight special arrangements made in advance, you're never going to get that stuff back. It just won't happen. It just won't happen. It becomes part of the plant. So you're going to have to write that stuff off. Now, the problem with that is once you leave, if this is a contract manufacturer, for example, or supplier, you know, they haven't forgotten how to make those products. They remember. And they've got your tools and dyes and molds. And so once you're gone, they're going to start producing the same products again and probably sell them either under a different brand or to the third world. But, you know, they're going to continue to produce and try to sell the same products. So, you know, that's you know, a kind of IP theft, I guess, but something that you need to be very aware of. When, you know, when I was helping companies move to China, we told them, you know, there's two strategies to avoid IP theft. One of them is to always produce a down rev. So produce last year's product or 2 years ago product. Don't produce the latest and greatest thing in China. You need to produce that in the Western world. And the other strategy is to produce different parts in different areas. So you might do, you know, some component parts in Shanghai and some component parts in Guangdong province and some component parts in Zhejiang province, and then have final assembly done in Hong Kong or something like that. That way no one plant knows how to produce the entire product. That's a good strategy for protecting your IP.
I have another question for you, being that that first one was such a good question. How about in a situation where the American manufacturer is aware of all these things that you just mentioned and the complexities, if in fact it doesn't work out for him to be in China? How would it work if in fact that American company would buy a manufacturing plant in China or become a partner in a manufacturing plant in China, and somewhere along, and they're producing parts and everything is going along fine, but for whatever reason wants to come back. Does he have the same problems in that regard, considering that his company is really under the name of a Chinese organization?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are several business models. I think you're talking about what we would call a woofie, which is a wholly owned foreign enterprise. That's what it's called in China. That's where you own the enterprise and manufacture there. And obviously, if it's yours and you're controlling it, then you probably can get your tools back and that kind of thing. But you're still going to have employment contracts that you need to pay attention to. And you're still going to have to apply for a permit to leave. So, you know, some things may be relieved, but others may not be. The other thing that I, you know, encourage, you know, we were talking earlier about this is a more strategic, thoughtful time than it was in the past. So I usually tell executives I'm working with, really, do you want to completely shut down? Or do you have a market in Asia that you could serve from that manufacturing site? So maybe you pare down the size a little bit, bring some manufacturing back, but keep some of your production in China. And, of course, the reason why is the Chinese market is growing at double digits. So not just China, but Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia, All across the ASEAN countries, the growth rates are pretty phenomenal. So you may want to continue to produce products that you're going to actually sell in the Asian market. And so you may want to keep part of your manufacturing open there.
Rosemary, you're a alumnus of the University of San Diego, and you're doing this with the University of San Diego. I'm assuming maybe the School of Business or the Institute for Supply Management. But I understand that you're not funded by them. Is that correct?
That's correct. We don't get any direct funding from the university. We just get support in kind. So we get office space and meeting space. We get admin support. We have help finding interns and that sort of thing. So they do they provide a lot of services for us, and of course we're able to use their name, which is, you know, pretty great, right? That's very valuable to us. We like being associated with the university and being really focused on research.
Okay, and now in terms of fundraising, what kind of funds does the institute need to operate?
Oh, what a great question. Thank you.
We're plugging for you.
Yeah, really. Yeah, so we exist on donations, on sponsorship, and also our small consulting projects. So as I had mentioned before, we have, from time to time, we'll get small projects where we do consulting work and we get paid for that. So those are usually $3,000 or $5,000, very small projects where we can help quickly and use our interns to be the researchers or the consultants on those projects. So it's a really good deal. I mean, I've been in the consulting world for so long, I know what it costs to have a regular consultant come in and do a project for you. So we have a very inexpensive way of doing similar projects, and they're high quality and so forth. So that's good. And then our sponsors, we're always looking for more sponsors. So they help us. They make contributions. And there are a lot of things that the sponsors get when they become a sponsor. A lot of advertising. They get, logos. So, for example, our website, the good people down at Google, down the street from where I live, give us $10,000 a month in advertising, which is amazing, right? I mean, it's really, really amazing. And
do you have
so,
that email address?
Yeah. So as a result, we get a lot of eyeballs to the reshoringinstitute.org. And so our sponsors, with their logos on our site, get the benefit of that as well. So a lot of people are seeing advertising in that regard. Then, I have to be honest, I'm doing a major contribution out of my own pocket because I believe in this. So I don't take a salary, and we don't have any salaries at all. We pay our interns, and we have some hourly support and so forth. So our budget is pretty small, and we're really frugal about this. But we do have expenses. So we have printing expenses, and we have to pay the interns, as I said, and so forth. So, we're open to taking all sponsors and donations. If anyone's interested, by all means, let me know.
Where would they go and make a donation? Is there something set up on your website?
Yes, there is. There's a donate button at the bottom of the page. So you can donate through PayPal, which takes credit cards also. So, yeah, there's a donations page. And then if anyone's interested in sponsorship, I would talk to them offline. And there are various levels of sponsorships and various things that you get as a result. So, as I said, our sponsors get the logo on our website with a lot of eyeballs. They get early access to research. They get directed research at certain levels. We invite them to all of our events, and so it's pretty good. We try to do something for our sponsors every month.
Would you like to give us that URL address again for our listeners?
It's www.reshoringinstitute.org.
Thanks, Rosemary. In closing, is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners, either about what the Reshoring Institute is doing, or what the university is doing, or the or what you are doing in projects that you're working on?
Well, I think, I think we gave a pretty good overview of the university and the institute. The one thing that I would encourage the listeners to think about is, you know, what could they bring back? What piece of their manufacturing could be brought back to America? It's really important that we rebuild the middle class in this way. You know, the manufacturing is the backbone of the economy, and we need to make sure that we're protecting it and that we're rebuilding it and that we're focused on the right things. So, you know, we really don't want the 23-cent an hour T-shirt production back. I mean, that doesn't make sense, and it doesn't pay a living wage. What we want is advanced manufacturing and thoughtful, strategic decisions made to bring the appropriate level of advanced manufacturing back or brand new to the U.S.
Well, that's great, and we appreciate you being on with us at Manufacturing Talk Radio. We'll certainly be talking again in the future, and we want to encourage our listeners to go to reshoringinstitute.org and check them out. If you have anything that's offshore and you're thinking about bringing it back, that's a great place to start. Lou, I want to go to you for just a moment. Oh, by the way, Rosemary, thank you for being on the show. We've really enjoyed having you.
That's my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Rosemary.
Lou, I want to go to you and get a kind of an update of next week.
Yeah, next week we have the organization called ACE, Automatic Commercial Environment, and that has a lot to do with about 80 U.S. Facilities within the government who are using all kinds of different software to plug in information for the government about logistics, about trade, and so on. And it's gotten very complex, needless to say, being that we've now become a global trading company. And ACE has developed a software program. It started 5 years ago. It was supposed to be completed in a year. They're going into their fifth year and $5 billion over budget. But we think that they're getting to a point that this program is going to go live by the summer. And they've been having some very serious problems. And we've had Celeste Gaetano on, and she is the Senior Global Strategist at Keywill, which is the software company, and Amy Magnus, who's the Director of Customs Affairs and Compliance. And they've been on our show before, and they're going to be doing an update as to what's happening in terms of the progress of this ACE program, which in itself, once implemented, is going to save a lot of money and save a lot of wasted time and effort by the various government agencies, where they'll be able to get all the information through one portal. So that should be interesting to our audience who are importers and exporters, and also for those who are not, and maybe they should be, certainly would be a helpful hint, a helpful development for their marketing and their manufacturing companies. So it should be an interesting show, and that's on March 29th between 1 and 2 Eastern Time, and we'll talk with you at that time. Tim?
I know that it's important for our listeners in between now and that show to make a phone call. I know Lou's company has already made that phone call to their logistics company to ask them, are they ACE compliant right now? Because fortunately, the company that All Metals and Forge Group uses to export its products said, yes, we are ACE compliant. But that may not be the answer you hear. And you want to know that, because if they're not, and this goes into gear, you could have some real headaches that we'd like to spare you. So make
well,
the call.
It could wind up being similar to the L.A. port issue, where you'll have shipped goods, you can't get it out, it's going to be stuck on the pier. There's 1,000 freight forwarders in the United States. They have a lot of clients, and as Tim put it, ask the question. Are you ACE compliant? That's the magic words. And if they're not, find out when they will be. If they're not and they don't tell you that they will be, You better find another freight forwarder.
Yeah, listen to our show next Tuesday. We'll be back with you then with Manufacturing Talk Radio. Lou, it's been great to be with you again today. We'll talk with you soon.
Thank you. Same to you, Tim.
And that
wraps
us up. Thanks
for joining us on Manufacturing Talk Radio. You can hear our next broadcast each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at mfgtalkradio.com.